This is a little flute improvisation based on my direct interpretation of looking at the beautiful ripples of water that are happening right now. Welcome to On the Brink Radio. This is being recorded in the Botanical Garden in Darwin, the largest city of the Northern Territory of Australia. It's Wednesday, the 5th of July, the year of our Lord's 2017. It's about 4:30 p.m. I'm at my very favorite spot here, a little bridge above a waterfall. It's an artificially created waterfall with two little ponds, a place where my former partner Lisbeth and I used to come and hang out and take really awesome photographs of the water flowing and the leaves floating on the water. And I've been lucky enough to be back in Darwin about 2 or 3 weeks after 2 very intensive and wonderful months on Magnetic Island, Queensland. This is the first time I've been back to Darwin since 2010. Some of the most powerful things in my life have happened to me here since I spent a few months here in 2004, in 2007, and in 2010. Darwin seems pretty much the same place as it did before, only just more so in all the different dimensions. More people, more traffic, more buildings, more military and industrial stuff, more noise. The noise levels have kind of leveled off the past 2 or 3 days, but for the 2 weeks before that, unbelievable, literally ear-shattering sound levels from Royal Air Force fighter planes taking off and zooming over Darwin at probably not more than a couple of 100 meters in elevation as part of Operation Pitch Black. But literally, on some mornings, there was almost 3 continuous hours of almost deafening noise. I mean, literally, almost causing a threshold of pain in my ears because I was outside. Then, Operation Pitch Black has just given way to, beginning on June 29th, Operation Talisman Sabre, which is going on now for the next month off of Rockhampton, Queensland, near Shoalwater Bay, part of the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Area. This is Australia's largest military war game exercise conducted with the U.S. Over 30,000 troops, over 20 giant U.S. and Australian warships, submarines, amphibious landings, helicopters, jet fighter planes. Every possible dimension of war fighting is going to be going on. I think that they're doing now, massive sonar, microwaves, depleted uranium, testing of weapons that we don't even know exist. All this stuff, it's literally not that much different from if an actual war was being fought. As Dr. Rosalie Bertel has pointed out so wonderfully and reiterated again by Dr. Claudia von Werloff, with whom I was lucky enough to talk on Skype for about 30 minutes last night. Dr. Bertel made the point that the sheer existence of the military-industrial complex, all these weapons and preparations for war, is really a totally parasitic influence on the body of Mother Earth, sucking out all her resources and human mind share and energy and time. And it's purely destructive, even if it's not waging war, just its existence. So this is a big part of the work of today, is trying to decloak the military-industrial juggernaut. Darwin, Northern Territory, the Darwin of the first decade of the 21st century, is a total example of the military-industrial juggernaut running off the rail, shattering the dreamtime tranquility that's existed for hundreds of thousands of years here. In this show, my first new show in 2 weeks, I didn't have a show last week because Jules Stanley, the producer and chief executive officer of UCY-TV, had to be hospitalized for a few days because of a medical emergency, but she's doing all right now. So I think the shows will be back online. So please send many beautiful healing blessings and prayers for Jewel Stanley. I did an interview with her a few weeks ago, and then she interviewed me. But she's a great asset to humanity and life on Mother Earth right now. I'm going to sort of walk around a few different parts of the botanical garden here now that the sun is going down. It's been a, even though it's the dead of winter, it's been a balmy 31 degrees centigrade by around 3 p.m. every day for the past week, which is, you know, it's a little warm, but it's nice. Now it's cooling down. I'm in the shade. I was almost thinking of having a dip in the pool here because nobody's around. But I've been swimming in the ocean every day, even though there theoretically could be crocodiles. And one was even seen not that long ago, but I sort of keep an eye out. This is not crocodile-infested territory, but it's definitely their territory. You've got to keep an eye out and be very aware when you're near the ocean, anywhere in the top end. One of the really nice things about where I'm standing right now is the ability to look down onto the surface of the water and watch all kinds of really beautiful reflections and ripples being generated by little bugs, little dragonflies having a sip of water, little bugs coming up from beneath, little bugs skimming on the surface, little things falling from the trees. And I could stand here and watch it all day. I've filmed quite a bit of footage here, but it's just so mesmerizing. And even though there's some background noise from Stewart Highway, it's not too bad right now, but it's just incredibly magical. Elizabeth and I made a film called To Why Why a Dreaming back in 2010. It's mainly footage of water that we shot in Litchfield National Park, which is about an hour and a half to the south of here. And we might have had some footage from the botanical garden here, but it's just very, very, very beautiful to watch these patterns of water. I was very lucky last week because Uncle Claver, who's the eldest elder of the indigenous people of the Wadak community, also called Port Keats, to the southwest of Darwin. That's where my friends Gregory and Aquaria work part of the time and live. My friends who I'm staying with here in Darwin, they've actually taken off just yesterday to go camping over that way for a week or two. But Uncle Claver was here helping Gregor to decipher some of their language because Claver's the last elder that fully knows their language. And when he passes on, anything that he hasn't been able to successfully transmit to other people is going to be lost. So Gregor's been engaged in a massive project to try to get him to, I don't know if translate is the right expression or not, but to try to sort of get the language out of him. It seems like a lot to do that's just been embarked on in a relatively short amount of time. But anyway, they're making a go for it, and I hope that the language is able to be passed on and preserved, because every indigenous language of any continent, any culture, any people represents a unique perspective, worldview, and cosmology, a unique piece of the puzzle of what it means to be here now as human beings on Mothership Earth. Every piece of the puzzle is just as important as every other piece. I wish you could see these beautiful ripples. I don't know how to convey it into sound. Maybe the music of my flute might express it more than anything else. Eva's Cafe here at the Botanical Garden has become my sort of little home away from home away from home. In my office here the past few days, due to the noise and chaos going on at the Gregor and Aquaria homestead there. It's a very beautiful environment beneath giant, beautiful trees, kind of in the shade, and really nice coffee and muffins and brownies with very good prices and really nice people. I've been able to sit there and write a lot of postcards, but I've also been doing a lot of brainstorming about what originally started out to be one Beyond film that's now evolved into becoming a series of Beyond films, a series of at least seven and possibly more full-length films based on my long-standing love of and work with and on behalf of the whales and dolphins and all my family of life in Mother Ocean and Mother Ocean herself, her nature, and the real global threats to her and her life from human military industrial civilization. Now, this is a very big picture project. But I've been making massive amounts of notes on all the different aspects of this lately, moving up to beginning to organize a lot of underwater footage from my marine biologist friends and actually starting to put these Beyond films together. And I'm working with quite a few really talented musicians who are contributing some music for the soundtrack. It's going to be a lot of original music and acoustic experimentation that I'm doing myself, integrated with a lot of whale and dolphin sounds and other kinds of underwater sounds. Also, hopefully some actual recordings of military industrial technologies. And I'm lucky enough to be working with a nice French guy named Gaetan, who's a HelpX person here where I'm staying. He's kind of an animation specialist working with an Adobe program called After Effects, and he's sort of beginning to show me some stuff about animating some of my artwork in order to not only bring some of my sea beings to life, but to share information in a sort of colorful, beautiful way that might be either impossible or difficult to share in a traditional filmmaking type format. For example, undersea military microwave technology. It'd be a lot easier to show that via an animation than it would be using real imagery. But one of the things I've really been thinking a lot about, especially as I stand here and ponder the beautiful reflections of the water, is the nature of water herself, the nature of Mother Ocean, and the one living entity that consists of all the water on Mother Earth, fresh water and all the lakes and rivers and streams and ice and clouds and in the atmosphere and the aquifers down in the ground and inside the bodies of every living thing. The water, wherever water is, if you look at the sum total of all of water, that's a containment vessel for all of life. Because as far as I know, there's really no life exists without water. Unless you want to talk about the borderland entities of viruses and nucleic acids. But I believe, well, cellular structures have to have water. I know that. Very, very interesting. But so much of my Beyond films are going to be totally non-linguistic. There might even be an entire 1.5 hour segment that may have no talking at all. I've thought of an interesting concept. There's a type of meditation that people go to. It's called Vipassana. I think it's Sanskrit, I'm not sure what it means, but the basic idea is that people learn to sit for long periods of time, I think even not only just many hours a day, but many hours a day for many days at a time, without speaking at all. And I'm not sure if they're allowed to speak in the night or anything, but I can really understand the wisdom of this, because it's following the advice of Carlos Castaneda and Don Juan to shut off the internal dialogue, the internal vocalizing process that's always creating sort of a linguistic barrier between our ability to be truly receptive to being here now. And even though it's ironic that I'm talking now and I'm talking about being quiet, but that is a big part of my work with my, for example, nonverbal talk radio, is to emphasize the usefulness, but also the disadvantages of being locked into linguistic communication. Okay, now I'm going to walk over to a couple of my really big tree friends and try to transduce some of their knowledge and wisdom. I'm now a few hundred meters away in the very bosom of giant grandmother tree. I don't know what variety of tree grandmother is, but I'm going to call her Arboreus giganteus. She's kind of like a Moreton Bay fig or a strangler fig, but very much like a pahutukawa tree. So if you imagine a pahutukawa tree of New Zealand crossed with a fig tree, giant root going along the ground, it's as big, it looks like the backbone of a whale, and limbs sticking out So the way its limbs stick out and come down and touch the ground and spread out for a long way is very much like the Pudicella, but the texture of the bark and the way that the limbs grow vertically off the large horizontal sort of trunks is very much more like a strangler fig. So I'm not sure what Jikanchi is, but this grandmother tree is the first tree that invited us to come and be with her. When I first came here on this trip, I guess about a week ago, I bicycled in from the entrance that comes from near Mendel Beach and was just drawn to come right under this big tree. It's a big shady area. A little nematon, if you will, the ancient Greek word for a sacred grove of trees. This is a mini nematon in the sense that it's the sacred enclosure of one tree. But I was really tired and I laid down on the picnic table and had a beautiful little nap. This was in the heat of the day, in the shade. And so I've come back and seen her every day, at least once. And now we've come here to sit and ask her for some wisdom and guidance. Grandmother Arboreus Giganteus, what wisdom do you have to share with us?
Well, Jeff, my voice, as you will know, sounds a lot like Grandmother Pudicella on Aotea. She is a very close friend of mine. Our families are related back in time, as you understand it. I would like to thank you on behalf of the Kingdom of the Trees for all your beautiful work and your playing of your beautiful, beautiful flute music for us and honoring all of my family here in the Darwin Botanical Garden, especially Grandmother Baobab across the way there and all family of Boabs and Baobabs that all especially loves your flute music.
Grandmother, that's very nice of you. That means so much for you to say that. I want to thank you for your beautiful shade and the power, and I'm sitting on one of your limbs right now.
Oh, Jeffrey, that's all right. I like having you here. I'd like to say that we're, meaning the Kingdom of the Trees, our ancient knowledge and wisdom, our spirit, we are very worried about life on Mother Earth, and not so much about the survival of life herself, but about mainly your species, the human race.
Grandmother, I fully share that concern, and I don't know what to think sometimes, especially with what's been happening in Darwin the past couple of weeks.
Yes, Jeffrey, we are very aware of the increased military-industrial activities in this area.
Oh, my God, and I feel so bad about the noise that all the living beings here has to endure.
Oh, and that's not even the worst of it. We're especially sensitive to microwave radiation.
Oh, my God, because trees are kind of like, very much are, antennas for optical light, and if you would be highly receptive to optical wavelengths, then you would probably be equally receptive to many other different bandwidths and frequencies of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Yes, Jeff, that's precisely correct.
Oh, my God. Well, I apologize to you on behalf of my species, which I really don't even identify with a lot of the time. I don't think that humanity is itself right now. It's the humanity of the Kali Yuga.
Yes, we understand the long cycles of the galactic seasons, and we understand that as a whole, you aren't your true selves right now. Yet that does not preclude your responsibility for your actions.
Yes, and I fully agree. And I'm just really afraid that the whole planetary, military-industrial juggernaut, it's so far out of our control. It's got a mind of its own. And I'm not attributing this mentality to some kind of extraterrestrial being, but to just sort of like some kind of weird emergent property of the complexity and driving forces and factors of this mega-technology that has just kind of got a mind of its own.
Yes, Jeffrey, we have been observing this for a long time, and we know that for every tree that's cut down, a very special cosmology has been lost, just like if you lose the language of an indigenous species.
Yes, I was just talking about that earlier. There's a little scrub fowl coming by to dig for some grubs here right in front of me. Yes, the kingdom of the trees. Every variety, every member of every species of tree has its own unique perspective and knowledge and wisdom to offer the greater whole of all of the consciousness of life on Mother Earth. And I do my best to try to connect with and absorb and honor and cherish and transduce the knowledge and wisdom and the beauty and power of being here now with all the trees and all the members of my family of life.
Jeffrey Wefferson, we'd really like to thank you on behalf of the Kingdom of the Trees. And now, you should go and talk with Grandmother Baobab across the way there before the sun goes down.
Oh, Grandmother Arboreus Giganteus, I love you. Thank you so much for your wisdom and for sharing, and we'll come back and see you tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. And be well and safe on your bicycle.
I'm now beneath Grandmother Baobab from Africa. I believe she's from Madagascar, but she's very big. And I want to thank you, Grandmother Baobab, for having us here. There's little green ants crawling all over me in my camera.
Well, Wefyups, well, welcome to be with me. What I'd like to do is transmit to you knowledge and information and wisdom telepathically, even after you've left here now, because right now the ants are swarming on you and it may be a bit uncomfortable.
Oh, thank you for that, Grandmother. It's so beautiful to be here.
Yes, Wefyups, we love your flute music. All our family of the Boabs and the Baobabs loves you, and especially Grandmother uptown next to the Woolworths, because you went and cleaned up all the rubbish around her one day.
Oh, that was so beautiful. That's my responsibility.
This is a lovely time of day when the sun's going down.
Yes, it is. And I might, maybe I'll go out to the ocean and see the sun go down. But will you beam us your knowledge and information and wisdom?
Yes, Wefyups, I will always do that to you from now on. And please come back anytime.
I love you, Grandmother Baobab.
We love you too, Wefyups. From the Kingdom of the Trees, blessings to you and all of your friends and family.
Now I'm sitting here at Vestes Beach. That's about halfway between the Botanical Garden and back to Fanny Bay where I'm staying. But the sun, Grandmother Teoa, is just about to go down. Her lower limb is only about a minute or two away from touching the horizon of the ocean. It's very beautiful. There's several dozen sailboats out in the water here, anchored. Normally I've been watching the sunset from East Point, but it's very beautiful. This is part two of On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 205, 206. This is being recorded on Thursday, the 6th of July. I'm back in the Botanical Garden. I'm sitting right at the top of a little artificial waterfall where I recorded the beginning of my show yesterday, but this time I'm right at the waterfall. You can hear it. It's about 5 meters tall. Totally artificial, but the water flowing over it is very real. But I find the sound to be very soothing, and I'm really looking forward to going to visit Litchfield National Park sometime in the next week or so. A national park with about at least a couple of dozen really big natural waterfalls that are spring-fed, and so they never dry up even at the peak of the dry season. In the second part of the show, I wanted to talk about Australia as a land of extremes. It's the country where I probably spent more time than anywhere else in the past 17 years. Almost as much time in New Zealand. But I've come to know Australia very well, a lot better than most of the people who live here. And not just because I actively love her as a country and a land and the indigenous people, the spirit of the land, but also because I don't live in one place all the time. I'm in constant motion, and I stay places long enough to get to know them and to form a really deep connection, like for, you know, a couple of months at a time. Like I've just spent in Tasmania and on Magnetic Island here on this trip, coming to have a real connection with places, but yet not being there all the time, and then coming back to visit gives you a really enhanced and broader perspective on the reality of what places actually are and the kinds of changes that are happening there that become invisible to the people that are exposed to, say, for example, military industrial development. If they see the same view out their window every day, they don't notice the gradual changes. But when you go away for a year and come back, and there's all these buildings and, you know, factories and mine sites and missile bases there and stuff, you notice it very clearly. So I try to share this awareness with people. The top end of Australia is a very unique part of this continent, country. It's an area that a lot of Australians have never been to, just like a lot of Australians have never been to Tasmania. And I guess, you know, statistically speaking, most Australians live in Brisbane, Melbourne, and Sydney, concentrated on the southeastern part of the eastern coast. That's probably, I'd say that's probably 80% of the whole population of Australia, which is really smaller than the population of Los Angeles. So all of Australia has fewer people than Los Angeles in a country that's probably a little larger than the continental USA. The top end of Australia, mainly an area called Arnhem Land, has the highest population of truly indigenous Australians here. I'm not sure of an exact figure, but a few years ago it was estimated that there was between 70 and 80,000 full-blooded indigenous people left living up here, which is still a very healthy population, not compared to the 2 or 3 million people that were here before European invasion, but it's still a pretty good number of people. And they're in their own land. Arnhem Land is a very big area. Maybe, I mean, this is just off the top of my head, Arnhem Land may be as big as Texas. And so this is an area that's strictly Aboriginal territory. It may be divided up geopolitically into different regions according to different language groups. And this may or may not reflect the true kind of traditional indigenous territories that exist that I really don't know. But Arnhem Land, you can't just rock up and drive in there. You've got to have a permit. And I think these permits are probably really easy to get, especially if you do it through a tourism agency. I'm sure for you want to pay the price, you get pretty much anybody can drive a vehicle up in there and go around and do tourism-type things. Because the indigenous people of Australia, again, that's a big generalization. A lot of them are still the more or less traditional people that really do love the earth, and they aren't in favor of the mining industry, of the gas industry, of big oil, of uranium, the military bases and microwave installations and stuff like that, although they probably still do drive around in pickup trucks with mobile phones and televisions and consume alcohol and enjoy all the accoutrements of the European civilization. So, you know, that's no less paradoxical than the typical quote-unquote white person who thinks that they're an environmentalist, yet they still partake of all these things. And that's pretty much all of us to a different degree. At the top end of Australia, clearly demonstrates the paradoxes or conflicts happening in Australia right now, but it's more extreme. Like, the top end is more extreme in several ways. It's extreme in its proximity to Southeast Asia and its distance from the main population centers of Australia. It's more extreme in its climate because it's got a full-on hot, dry climate. That I think the latitude here is, it's either 12 or 16 degrees south, so it's equatorial. Like, it's probably about 30 or 31 degrees centigrade now, even though I'm sitting in the cool shade of a forest. But it can be very oppressive in the other months of the year and during the wet season. And Darwin also has one of the highest concentrations of military presence anywhere in Australia. Not far south of here, just a few hundred kilometers south near Capri, is the first truly officially acknowledged U.S. military base in Australia. I believe it's called Bradshaw, the Bradshaw facility, or it might be called Delamere, one of these two. But even though there's probably about 40 or more de facto U.S. military bases in Australia, most of them jointly operated. And that's not even including electronic warfare and surveillance and telecommunications facilities like the notorious Pine Gap facility near Alice Springs, which is an American Boeing-owned and operated facility that's been there since the 1970s. Totally underground. Darwin has this military presence. When I first came here a couple of weeks ago, it was right at the beginning of a thing called Operation Pitch Black that they have every 2 years. It's where what seems like every fighter plane that the Royal Australian Air Force owns zooms and flies over the coast of Darwin here many times a day at an elevation of about 100 or 200 meters, going as fast as they can and as loud as they can. I mean, it's literally unbelievable. It sounded like continuous thunder, only a lot louder. These sounds sometimes for 2 or 3 hours, literally a continuous wave of sound for 2 or 3 hours. It was far, far, far louder than any thunder you've ever heard, and far more of a different acoustic quality that was very, it felt like it was damaging to my hearing. But so many of the people here just don't even, they think it's cool. You know, there's a lot of the mentality up here of what we call rednecks. Down in the South in America, people like to jack up their cars and have really loud motors that waste fuel, and they like to just run them really loud so they can hear them and go as fast as they can down the road. And it's the same mentality that had a heyday last Saturday, which was July 1st. That is called Territory Day. It's sort of like the Northern Territory's 4th of July when they celebrate their becoming a state separate from South Australia, whenever that happened. But it's really just an excuse for a giant piss-up, and for people, it's the only day of the year people can legally shoot off fireworks. So that evening and night, I rode my bicycle down the Mindle Beach, which is a few kilometers. It's the big public beach where the market is. And there they had a massive fireworks display, but for several kilometers all along the beach was everyone and his brother was shooting off fireworks. And it was coming back after dark, right when it was all peeking out. It was very surreal, with giant clouds of smoke that smelled of gunpowder and things blowing up and shooting off all around you. And you never knew when somebody was going to throw something down on the road right in front of you. Or, you know, and I heard ambulances going quite often. People must have blown off some limbs or blown out some eyes and stuff like that, or killed your kids. But it really reminded me of Apocalypse Now, that movie by Francis Ford Coppola. Very, very much like that. Didn't hear any choppers, though. But what made sense to me was that they could have just drawn out Operation Pitch Black another couple of days. They could have had all these really loud fighter planes zooming over at the same time as they were having all these fireworks. That would have been a truly a redneck extravaganza where they probably would have just shat themselves out of joy. It's like a bioacoustic nightmare those first couple of weeks that I was back, partly because I'm staying in my tent at my friend's house, so I'm sort of outside pretty much all the time. And that's good. That's by choice. But it makes you very tuned into the acoustic environment where you are. A lot of times I would notice that when these planes would fly over, that birds would make all kind of weird noises, like they were startled or scared, and it was very disturbing that that went on so intensely for so long. And then now, just about 4 or 5 days ago, Australia's largest war game, which that's actually an oxymoron, a war game called Talisman Sabre, is going on all around Australia, but the main focus of it is amphibious land, air, and sea operations and maneuvers going on, centered on a place called Shoalwater Bay, which is in the southern part of the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Area off of Rockhampton in Queensland. Over 30,000 U.S. and Australian troops are going to be doing every possible thing, just like in war. And I think that probably the only difference between these war games and actual war is that hopefully there won't be any human casualties. But you never know. But that's not counting casualties to non-human life, like all the life in the ocean, the sea turtles and the whales and dolphins and the fish and the stingrays and the seahorses and eels and everybody that lives in the ocean is just going to be under attack by all this stuff just as much as if it was real war. So I fail to see the difference between a war game and actual war. My beautiful friend, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, who passed away in June of 2012, was a very poignant observer and commentator on the global military-industrial juggernaut, as well as being an expert in the hazardous biological effects of ionizing radiation, which is something that's invisible to most people in the world of today. And I don't mean visibly invisible, I mean psychologically invisible. Dr. Bertel, in her book, Planet Earth, Latest Weapon of War, which a newly revised edition of is supposed to be coming out soon, according to Dr. Claudia von Wurloff, who I just talked to on Skype a couple of nights ago. The sheer existence of all this military stuff is one of the greatest socioeconomic and environmental hazards that we have. And it's so vast and so big. And the whole military economy is much greater than the whole civilian economy, yet it's basically invisible. Just the existence of all the military stuff is in itself a form of warfare. All the resources and time and energy that it takes to manufacture all these weapons and constantly making them obsolete and constantly creating new ones, developing new ones, trying to stage fake crises in the world, like the whole war on terror, and the whole North Korean missile thing. All these are bogeys, just like climate change, to try to convince the public that the solution for all these crises is exactly what the New World Order transnational international banking cartel corporations want: continuously evolving revolutions and military affairs. In reading some articles by an organization called FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, they pointed out that a U.S. government NGO think tank called CSIS is one of the main advisors to the U.S. government on the development and acquisition of new weapons systems. And so this organization was strongly using the North Korean missile thing as a rationale for the U.S. to invest in a massive new multi-billion dollar nuclear missile system called THAADS, T-H-A-A-D-S, that's designed and manufactured by Lockheed. Well, as it turns out, Lockheed is the chief financial contributor to this CSIS organization. So in other words, it's Lockheed recommending that the U.S. government invest in a whole bunch of their new missiles to place them in South Korea against the wishes of most of the South Korean people. Along that same line, last year, there's a giant area in South Australia called Woomera. This is where all the nuclear testing was done. It's an area about the size of Texas. Well, this area was just basically handed over to another top U.S. military defense contractor called Raytheon. Raytheon's one of the top corporations that manufactures microwave weapons and surveillance systems used by the U.S. Navy and other countries. And also, they're one of the top nuclear missile manufacturers. Australia really is under attack. It's a land of great contrasts. The beauty and power of nature and the dream time. There's no other place like it on Mother Earth. The power and beauty of this land, just that I can talk about from my own experience, the places I've been lucky enough to be able to visit and spend time and live over the past 17 years, that I've really been embraced by and have fallen in love with this very beautiful country, continent, island that's so dear to my heart. But she is totally under attack. Everywhere I go, it's like Australia under attack, nightmares of the dreamtime. Everywhere I go, there's just clear evidence of Mother Earth and all things good and true and beautiful being under attack by stupid human stuff driven mainly by greed. Like in Tasmania, the ongoing debacle of the logging industry trying to chop down all the biggest trees anywhere, but especially in this remote area of the West Coast called the Tarkine. Then when I went to the Warren Bungles to visit Malcolm Hartley, the comet astronomer, there, that whole area, especially an area called the Pilliga, is under attack by Santos, who wants to do fracking everywhere. This was going to totally destroy the groundwater and create a lot of light pollution at night that'll render these optical observatories dysfunctional. Then when I went to Kallang, in northern New South Wales, there, they're battling against a massive coastal logging project by the government of New South Wales that would destroy the habitat for so much wildlife, especially lots of koalas. Then on Yunbanuna Magnetic Island, where I was lucky enough to see Uncle Arthur Johnson, the eldest elder of the Walguru Kaba people again. He's fighting a lot of legal battles, not just about land rights of the island, but about the Adani mega coal mine and ore loading facility that's going to be built there at Abbott Point and to mine in the Galilee Basin, inland from there, which, if it goes ahead, it'll be probably the largest ore loading facility in the world, using hundreds of millions of liters of water a day for free. I mean, it's unbelievable what's being allowed to progress. Also, the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage area there, under so much attack from undersea warfare activities that are invisible to most people. Cairns has a major submarine base, and we don't really have that much of an idea of the total amount of submarine activity, but I think it's vastly larger than anyone thinks because of the trend that marine biologist Terry Lilly has observed, that due to even weak but still existing environmental regulations in America, the U.S. Navy still just doesn't totally have carte blanche to do whatever it wants. And so they've been shifting all their undersea warfare activities down under to New Zealand and Australia, because here they can be even more invisible and pretty much do whatever they want, both in terms of practicing, preparing for quote-unquote war, but also part of the Pacific pivot and the rationale of surrounding China, which I think is all just another bogey, that it's part of the ongoing game to convince the public that they need all these weapon systems, when the reality is that all these weapons are really designed to kill life as we know it on Mother Earth, and especially ourselves. Then up in here in Darwin, you've got all the giant INPEX gas hub here that's probably fully online now, but the construction has leveled off. You've got the major Royal Air Force facility, the Delamere and Bradshaw bases down near Catherine, and probably other electronic warfare facilities and things that we don't even know about. So, I mean, these are just a few of the places that I've been in the past few months. But it's like that's the common thread. It's the Dreamtime under attack by the human military industrial complex. I have to make a notation here about Australian filmmaker named David Bradbury. He's a guy, I finally got to meet him for the first time last year, just for about 15 minutes, near Ocean Shores. But I got in touch with him back in 2003 because he made a couple of really cool films that were big steps towards educating the public about the global nuclear scenario, and especially the use of depleted uranium. He made a really cool film called Blowing in the Wind about depleted uranium, and he focused on the use of DU by Australian and American forces at Shoalwater Bay, which is where Talisman Sabre is happening right now. And then his next film was called A Hard Rain, which was also a look at the global nuclear scenario. Well, after these films, he sort of dropped off the face of the earth. And just a couple of months ago, he's kind of come out of hibernation, which I applaud his efforts to get back in the swing of things, because he was doing some really good work. But when you listen to what he's talking about, it's like his thinking hasn't changed in 14 years. He's still talking about some very significant threats to, for example, marine life, like sonar, and he's talking about depleted uranium, but sure, these are as real as ever, and of course they're very, very, very important, but he's not even mentioning anything about the whole new electronic warfare microwave paradigm that's so dominant in all of the military stuff on land, sea, and air. And he's also talking about the Australia's carbon footprint, as if he's the one thing he has picked up on from his hibernation was the Manhattan Project of Public Relations called climate change. So anyway, when you listen to what he's talking about, rather than making constructive observations on what's going on and what's different now than what he ever talked about before and what we can do about it, he's basically whinging and pointing the finger at America for all of its war activities and how bad it is that all the Australian people are always going along with America to go and fight wars. And that's hardly the case. I mean, I pointed out in a message to him today that England is by far the most genocidal country this planet's ever seen. And yet, who's pointing any fingers at England? You know, and I said to Bradbury, I go like, you know, without the intervention or the influence of England and America, what would Australia be? I mean, literally, what would it be? It would be the land of the Dreamtime with the happy indigenous people still living here as they have for hundreds of thousands of years if England and America had never set foot here. So what good has come from the presence of America and England here? But, you know, I don't know. I wish David Bradbury would get a clue and bring himself up to date on what's really going on in the world. He did get to interview Dr. Rosalie Bertel, and I think they mainly talked about ionizing radiation and the health effects. So I tried to ask him about that footage and what all they talked about, but he's never communicated with me about it. That's all from the waterfall. I'm going to bicycle out to a place called East Point, a reserve where I often go and watch the sunset, and there I'll record the concluding portion of this episode of On the Brink Radio. I've now bicycled a few kilometers out to East Point, where I just had a beautiful swim in the ocean for the first time in a couple of days. So beautiful, nice and clear, and not cold, not hot, not warm, just cool, very beautiful. The sun's probably about 30 or 45 minutes from going down. You can definitely tell the days are getting longer again now since the solstice. Bicycling out here in the distance, coming from Pee-wee's Cafe, I heard some music that I recognized as the music of an old friend of mine that I knew in Darwin back in 2007. He goes by the name of MD. He's a didgeridoo player. And I heard the music. It was their sound check for a corporate gig he's doing at this little cafe. It's didge and drums. So it was pretty cool. It's a bit frenetic and upbeat. But I stopped and talked to him. He recognized me. We had a little chat. So that was quite cool. Very interesting connection. I wanted to close the show by sharing my ongoing deepening connection with the indigenous people of Australia, who I consider to be, as a whole, the coolest and most wonderful and gentle people on this whole planet, of human people, that is. On this trip in particular, I've been really getting more and more insight into the extreme complexity of the whole scenario of the indigenous people here, the First Nations Australians, understanding, you know, how they relate among themselves, both within their own tribe or nation and between other tribes and nations and between members of families. And I mean, it's got all the potential for conflict and drama that any non-Indigenous people would have, but in some ways it seems even more amplified or exacerbated, probably because of a number of different factors, not the least of which is that they're, as a whole, being forced to live embedded in a culture that's not their own, that they've more or less adapted to with varying degrees of success. But the Aboriginal people here tend to have a lot of health problems as they get older from various reasons of living within the quote-unquote white society. I think a lot of it's dietary, a lot of it's spiritual and emotional, psychological. They don't have the tolerance to alcohol that the white man has, even though there's not really a white man. Anyway, but I've really been deeply embraced by a lot of very interesting and nice indigenous people. And I'd first like to honor the ancestors of Tasmania, Truganini and Manalarngana, two of the leaders of the nine nations of indigenous people of Tasmania, both of whom died at relatively young ages. But I always honor their spirit whenever I'm there. They both lived on the East Coast, Truganini near Oyster Cove, Oyster Bay, south of Hobart, and Manalarngana to the northeastern coastal nation. And I was also able to spend some time at the lovely Tiagara Aboriginal Center there at Devonport, which was really special. That's a very powerful place. In Klang, New South Wales, I was connecting with a lot of spiritual energy from the valley there where my friends lived, which was supposedly a men's sacred site. Then when I left there, I went north and stopped near Noosa to see Barbara Randall, who is the widow of Uncle Bob Randall, who was one of the custodians of Uluru, as well as a kind of spiritual representative or spokesperson on behalf of all the indigenous people of Australia, and really all the indigenous people of the world, kind of like. I'm not a fan of the Dalai Lama, but Uncle Bob Randall was kind of like a Dalai Lama of the Aboriginal people of Australia. I first saw him in this film called Utopia by John Pilger, and really was very drawn to his way that he described everything. And I painted a beautiful hand-painted rock for him that you'll see as my profile photo on Facebook. And when I was on my way to give it to him 2 years ago, he passed away. So I've kept that rock, and it's brought me some really interesting connections, including meeting Barbara Randall, his widow. But it's been hanging out with her that I started to see the real, oh my God, inconceivable complexity and dramas that can happen between Aboriginal people and their families and their ancestors and their legal spouses and people they've worked with and all different kinds of stuff. It's like a nightmare, actually. It's so ironic because of his beautiful spiritual legacy. Then on Magnetic Island or Yunbanoon, I caught up with Uncle Arthur Johnson back when I was there. There's a helicopter flying over. He was the indigenous elder of the Walguru couple people who I painted with last year for 3 weeks. He didn't have time to paint with me this time, but I did get to see him. And I left him 3 or 4 partially finished paintings and a whole bunch of paint left over from my murals that hopefully he'll finish. But he's fighting a lot of legal battles with the Adani coal mine and land rights there on Magnetic Island. Then, through my friend Grace Geiger, I got in touch with the eldest elder of the Gugu Yanjiri people that live up sort of north of Cape Tribulation. His name's Gobble, or CJ, and I didn't meet him, but we talked on the phone, and I sent him a really nice painted rock with a rainbow serpent on it. Then, here in Darwin, a couple weeks ago, Uncle Claver from Wada was there for a week, and he taught me some of his words, and I painted a really nice set of rocks and gave them to him to take back to Wada, which is where Gregor and Aquaria are now. It's really funny, there's dozens of tiny little crabs crawling all over my toes. That's so funny, because I'm on the beach. There's about a dozen of them climbing up my toes and going underneath them. On both feet, actually, I can feel them. Very interesting. Well, the sun's going to be going down soon. I wish everyone a beautiful, beautiful day, evening, night, whatever time of day it is. Thanks for listening to this episode of On the Brink Radio, and I'm welcoming Jewel Stanley back from a week in the hospital. Maybe it forced her to take a break and chill out for a while. But sending you love and blessings from the top end of the territory. May Goddess bless all the Homo sapiens and help Mother Earth to cleanse herself of the Homo sapien macrovirus. Over and out, this is Jeff Weverson. Good day.